I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date. Whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the Operating Engineers Local 139, Madison Teamsters Local 695, Madison Firefighters Local 311, Madison Teachers Incorporated. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times. John, I know we had the dueling town halls last night, but I want to lead with something that actually Keith Olbermann brought to my attention. I watch his daily podcast now. This is the junior senator from Nebraska, Ben Sasse.
I'm not at all apologetic for having fought for my values against his in places where I think his are deficient, not just for a Republican, but for an American. So the way he kisses dictators' butts, the United States now regularly sells out our allies under his leadership. The way he treats women and spends like a drunken sailor, he mocks evangelicals behind closed doors. His family has treated the presidency like a business opportunity. He's flirted with white supremacists. At the beginning of the COVID crisis, he refused to treat it seriously. First, he ignored COVID, and then he went into full economic shutdown mode. He was the one who said 10 to 14 days of shutdown would fix this, and that was always wrong. I mean, and so I don't think the way he's led through COVID has been reasonable or responsible. I'm worried that if President Trump loses, as looks likely, that he's going to take the Senate down with him. I'm now looking at the possibility of a Republican bloodbath in the Senate, and that's why I've never been on the Trump train. It's why I didn't agree to serve on his reelection committee, and it's why I'm not campaigning for him.
Now, you're a much better historian than I am, John. You know that earlier this year, at the end of last year, there was an impeachment. How did Senator Sasse vote on impeaching Donald Trump?
He was a locked in early on, absolutely secure yes man for Donald Trump.
Oh.
He was there when Trump needed him. And he is, to my mind, a far guiltier player than many of the people who are out campaigning for Trump.
Now,
because somebody like Ben Sasse wants to have it both ways, right? And the fact is, if he believed half of what he just said in that interview, if he believed half of it, he should have voted to remove the president.
Now, when President Trump stood next to Vladimir Putin and threw 16 intelligence agencies under the bus, throwing his own director of national security, Dan Coats, a former senator, under the bus. Did Ben Sasse go to the airwaves in Omaha and Lincoln and North Platte and Scotts Bluff and condemn him?
I'd have to check the record on that, Sly. I don't recall.
Oh, okay.
It's not burned into my memory. And you see, this is the thing. Ben Sasse has done this forever. Right? Again, he's a far worse player than some of those, you know, lockstep conservatives who actually believe in Trump. Because what Sasse does, very similar to what Susan Collins and a few other folks do, is they want to play well outside of Trump's orbit, right? They want to position themselves for the future. They want to appeal to people who aren't particularly impressed with Trump. And so in safe moments, they will come out and say, you know, rather profound things. And a lot of our dimwit media will cover them and make a big deal. Oh, did you hear what he said? Wow, that's amazing. People are breaking with Trump. But at the critical moment, when Mitch McConnell needs to organize the Senate, when there is a cabinet nominee where it's a close vote, when there's a critical vote on something like the Affordable Care Act, when there are votes on holding Trump to account on an issue like impeachment, these people are never with you. They're never there.
Now,
on the Supreme Court nomination, they're now, never there.
Just looking at the raw politics of this, while Nebraska is safely in Donald Trump's corner, and by the way, this is getting very little attention in Nebraska, interestingly enough. Nebraska, like Maine, allocates its electoral votes by congressional district. And there is one congressional district, which is essentially the city of Omaha and a little bit of the surrounding area, that is quite competitive. What? And right now, I was just looking at Nate Silver's 538. He says, you know, the odds are better than 50-50 that Joe Biden will win that district. Does this type of thing have any effect on that?
It could. It could. And in this case, it has relevance because that Omaha district does, in the presidential race, it's usually pretty close, but it also sends a Republican to the House of Representatives. And there's a really tight race for that seat. Kara Eastman, who is a fantastic progressive, is the Democratic nominee out there. She hasn't always had the full support of the Democratic Party, but they're starting to get interested in her because she's very close. Some polling actually showing her effectively tied. And so you could have a situation out in that congressional district where Biden carries, where Kara Eastman wins the seat. And part of that, part of what would make it work is, you know, folks who are swing voters, and they actually have them out in Omaha and that surrounding area. Folks who are swing voters who hear Sass and go, okay, you know, he's maybe not a reliable guy up in the Senate, but what he's saying is true, and running down that list very effective. So you might see some people swing over. But here's the bigger thing, Sly. This is the really important thing about this handful of Republicans who are now calling Trump out, or at least are distancing from Trump. It may not cause people to swing over to vote for Biden or for a Democratic candidate for the Senate or the House, but it may cause a portion of Republican voters or Republican-leaning voters to just throw their hands up and say, screw it, and stay home. And that, to me, I think that's the much bigger threat for Donald Trump. Donald Trump runs the risk this time around of having happened to him what happened to Hillary Clinton in 2016. And that is that people didn't cross party. They didn't necessarily cross lines and vote for the candidate of the other party, but a lot of folks just stayed home.
Well, and of course, Donald Trump has been essentially encouraging people to wait to vote till Election Day, which now maybe doesn't look like such a great decision on his part. All right, we had dueling town halls last night. I just watched the highlights. I really didn't want to, frankly. I didn't. I watched
it. I tried, and it actually made you dizzy.
Yeah.
Because they had commercials. So during the commercial break, I decided to commit to the Biden town hall on ABC because it was actually official and real, you know, rather than playing a game. So I was watching the Biden town hall, but then when they went to commercials, ABC, they went to commercials, which were extensive, then I'd switch over to NBC and watch the Trump town hall.
Well, here...
Can I just say, before you play clips, which will be really good, but it was mind-blowing to do that because Biden never raised his voice. It was this...
Well, it's very, very interesting that you bring this up. You know, I think he's retired now, but the advertising executive, Donnie Deutsch, who's quite a common guest on Morning Joe, was talking about that this morning. He said, look, I think Americans are tired. They're tired of noise. They're tired of all the bellicose rantings of Donald Trump. They're tired. And Joe Biden is playing, I almost pronounced his name like Sarah Palin, Joe O'Biden. Joe Biden is playing a game of kind of like trying to calm things down a little bit.
I think that's exactly right. And it was fascinating when you flip back and forth. I promise you, every time I did it, Biden was making a nuanced point. And often he would literally say to people, somebody would ask him a question, and he got tough questions. somebody would ask him a question, Biden would answer at length, and then he would say, I hope I answered your question. Did I? Or Stephanopoulos would come in and say, was that satisfactory to you? And if the person, you know, said, well, you know, maybe I'm still a little or whatever, Biden would go back in. You know what I mean? Something you almost never see in politics, which is it was an honest dialogue where, you know, he was actually trying to convince people and trying to get to them, acknowledging his mistakes. He acknowledged his vote on the crime bill back in 94 was wrong. He acknowledged a number of other missteps in his past, but then, you know, kind of going deeper. Then you would go over to Trump. And I promise you, it would be Biden, you know, kind of willing to go deeper, willing to talk in this, you know, detailed way. And then Trump over, you'd hear Trump saying, yeah, I have a lot of money. Or I pay taxes somehow. You know, it was just this, it was all I.
Mm.
And it was all, you know, explaining, lying, basically, about something he was in trouble for. The distinction was stark.
So the other thing that former Vice President Biden did was he stayed after the town hall and answered people's questions that didn't get a chance to ask them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they ran the tape, by the way.
That is right out of, and I don't think it's out of Joe Biden's playbook. I just think it's who he is. But you'll remember that Bill Clinton did that as well. That is a trademark of Bill Clinton.
And people loved it. You know what I mean? It's because, weirdly enough, Bill Clinton was a very manufactured politician in a lot of ways, right? And yet, the one thing about him that wasn't manufactured was that he didn't just step away from the event when the event was finished. And as a result, people really did, who went to an event, held out hope that they could shake his hand, that they could talk to him for a moment, because, you know, he wasn't flying off to the next thing. And I remember an event back in 92 in Vandalia, Illinois, where he stayed the better part of 4 hours after his last rally of the night, because there were just thousands of people who had come. It was at a point where his campaign was really taken off in the late summer. And he worked that rope line for hours. And people stayed. I was talking to, like, you know, grade school teachers who'd come from Effingham, and they would say, yeah, you know, I went to the library and I read a section of a book about John Kennedy, because I think that's where we lost the thread, and I wanted to come and see if Clinton would pick it up. You know, it's like this very romantic stuff. And this would be like 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. They'd been out there for, you know, since late afternoon waiting, and I would watch it because I was doing close cover, which meant, you know, you're near Clinton as he walks. And I would watch him as he would get to these people, right? And he would listen to their stories. And you know that every one of those people went back and told 100 people about it, right? And so that's a part of politics that we've lost, and we've really lost it a lot in, obviously, this COVID moment. What Biden did last night didn't recreate it all. I mean, obviously, it's not a rope line and with thousands of people, but it is evidence of something that I think people do long for, and that is the notion that politicians aren't celebrities.
Well,
they actually are folks trying to get your vote. And that's a very different dynamic.
Here's my favorite moment, at least from what I've seen, of Savannah Guthrie, who did a very good job last night dealing with Donald Trump. I like this moment.
Just this week, you retweeted to your 87 million followers a conspiracy theory that Joe Biden orchestrated to have SEAL Team 6, the Navy SEAL Team 6, killed to cover up the fake death of bin Laden. Now, why would you send a lie like that to your followers?
You retweeted. That was a retweet. That was an opinion of somebody, and that was a retweet. I'll put it out there. People can decide for themselves. I don't take a position.
You're not like someone's crazy uncle who can just retweet whatever.
That was a retweet. And I do a lot of retweets.
Actually, he is someone's crazy uncle.
Yeah, I love that. Isn't she on TV quite a bit?
She is. She's become quite the celebrity. Yeah.
So he's officially a crazy uncle and a mean one who steals people's money. With that said, with that gentle proviso, to use that phrase, and what was fascinating was that Trump is so far off the deep end, you know, he's so far beyond the pale, that when a national TV figure, you know, an anchor, refers to him as someone's crazy uncle, he doesn't stop and say, hold it, that's over the line, or what do you mean?
No,
he just goes right on with it. He rolls with it.
It's a retweet. That's one of the most remarkable things.
I know. And you see, the standard on that is, it's sort of like, I realize not everybody's on Twitter, and I think there's, because there's a lot of still, you know, mentally sane and healthy people in this country. But as someone who is on Twitter, I can tell you that a lot of people put that little thing, retweets are not endorsements, right? Because they do want you to understand that they may be circulating something that they disapprove of because they want you to see it. I understand that. But Trump doesn't do that. He doesn't do retweets are not endorsements. In fact, he uses his Twitter feed to amplify political views and alliances that he's associated with, right? And he knows how people read his feed. He knows exactly, because he's actually a master at communicating. And so when he was doing that it's a retweet thing and all that, and riding through the crazy uncle talk, he was really lying to people.
What?
He amplifies things because he wants people to take him seriously. There's no doubt about
this
that.
Is quite and a revelation. Wait a minute. Different. This is quite a revelation. You said he was lying? What?
I know. It's hard for me to say because I know a lot of people still have really warm feelings for the president. But
I'm going to have to rename this lying. Podcast. That's quite the revelation.
Yeah, I know. You're going to put it on top, right?
All right, stand by. John Nichols with us from the Capital Times at SliceOffice.com.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson, we love guitars.
The attorneys at Gingras, Thompson, and Wachs have had the honor of receiving numerous awards for their work both in and outside the courtroom. But just as important as receiving accolades for being skilled attorneys, it's equally important to give back to the community in which they live and work. If you want a personal attorney that can help you in so many different areas, they've got them. They're in Eau Claire, Madison, Milwaukee, and Waukesha. They're easy to reach. GTWLawyers.com. That's GTWLawyers.com.
Welcome back to SliceOffice.com, brought to you by Madison Computer Works and also Jeff's Guitar Clinic. Joining us again, John Nichols, associate editor from the Capital Times. All right, I want to play a clip from Joe Biden. I don't really understand how Democrats ended up in the situation that this is a topic for conversation, but it is.
Well, right now, it looks like they're going to have a vote around Halloween. So if they vote on it before the election, you are open to expanding the court?
I'm open to considering what happens from that point on.
You know, you said so many times during the campaign, all through the course of your career, it's important to level with
the
American
people. It is, but George, if I say, no matter what answer I gave you, if I say it, that's the headline tomorrow. It won't be about what's going on now, the improper way they're proceeding.
But don't voters have a right to know where you
stand?
They
do have a right to know where I stand, and they'll have a right to know where I stand before they vote.
So you'll come out with a clear position before Election Day?
Yes, depending on how they handle this. But look, what you should do is you got to make sure you vote. And vote for a senator who, in fact, thinks reflects your general view on constitutional interpretation.
All right, now that is a change in Biden's tone on that question. In the past, he has said he's not going to talk about it. All right. How do you think he handled that?
It was uniquely awful. I mean, come on. Sort of like it's like with all due respect to Biden, but I thought, and I wrote a piece saying he won the debate that wasn't a debate. So you know, give him his high marks. But that answer is sort of kind of feeds every bit of cynicism you can imagine, right? It's evading the question, suggesting you'll answer it at some time down the line before the election. Well, the election's on November 3rd. What percentage of people who are participating in this election will have already voted by the time Joe Biden decides that he's going to tell us what he thinks about this issue, right? I mean, and he also saying, we'll see what they do.
Yeah, that's a Lindsey Graham sort of response. Because Lindsey Graham, and I'm not comparing Joe Biden to Lindsey Graham, but Lindsey Graham, you know, blamed the treatment of Brett Kavanaugh for his change on their rules on when to pick a Supreme Court justice. Yeah, after Kavanaugh, that's it.
Which had nothing to do with
how if you were running for president right now, it would be probably a slightly different race. How would you answer that question?
Very simply, I would say, look, the Supreme Court is not high priests. It's not a bunch of high priests who are, you know, chosen to reign above us. They are people who are chosen to serve us, and it's clear that this court isn't serving us. It's a really complex, messy situation, and frankly, I agree with the founders. It's time for reform. The founders of this country left many of the definitions of the high court gray. They left it up for interpretation. John Marshall and others jumped in and defined a lot. The Judiciary Act of 1869 actually defined more, that being done by Congress, not by the Constitution. And so an awful lot of what we think is set in stone is, in fact, stuff that was sort of accumulated along the way, barnacles, if you will, the notion that these justices serve life tenure. That is not in the Constitution. Many of the notions, even the notion of the size of the court, was not established in the Constitution. So what I would say is that as President of the United States, I will revisit the structures of the court, and that includes questions of how many members the court should have and how long members of the court should serve, whether they should have term limits, all of these issues. I'll revisit all of that, but I will do so in a bipartisan way that has respect for what law professors and lawyers and former justices have to say. It will be consultative. It will not be some big political ploy, as some of my own friends in my own party propose. It will be a sincere effort to make sure that the Supreme Court is removed from this ugly political gamesmanship.
What do you think of giving these justices 18-year terms, staggering the terms, so we don't have President Jimmy Carter getting no appointments and Donald Trump getting three, staggering them, kind of like the Board of Regents?
Well, I just wrote a piece on that this week for The Nation, based on the bill proposed by Congressman Ro Khanna that does set an 18-year term limit. And if you have an 18-year term limit, that means that, and you keep the nine justices, that means that a justice rotates off every 2 years, right? So every president of the United States would get two picks, roughly, you know, in a term. But what's interesting is what Khanna argues, and this is an important thing, it would refresh the court, right? You'd bring people who are in touch with the day-to-day lives, not somebody who's kind of been in this, you know, high priest situation for 40 years. And you would remove a lot of the pressure on individuals, right? If you are a justice who's been there a while, you know when you're going to leave. There's an easier flow. It makes when a justice does leave not a crisis situation, but something you can actually plan for and think about. Voters can actually vote on it. Because, you know, now we keep saying, oh, yeah, this is a very important election. It's all about the courts. But you don't even know whether there'll be a court opening or whether there'll be three court openings in a single term or whatever. And so it cleans up a lot of the process.
And then we shouldn't just be talking about reforming the Supreme Court. We should be talking about reforming the federal bench, right? Okay.
And can I tell you one final thing? What I just described there, that argument for it, that it would refresh the court, it would, you know, take some of the pressure off the appointment process. Do you know that there was a memo to Fred Fielding, who was the White House counsel under Ronald Reagan, written in Ronald Reagan's first term by a young assistant in Fred Fielding's office who entertained all these ideas, didn't necessarily endorse them, but raised these as good arguments for term limits on judges. And you know who that young assistant was? John Roberts.
Interesting.
So if I was asked that question, that's the kind of story I would tell.
All right. Here is another interesting moment. George Stephanopoulos asked Joe Biden what he'd do if he lost.
If you lose, what will that say to you about where America is today?
Well, it could say that I'm a lousy candidate. and I didn't do a good job. But I think, I hope that it doesn't say that we are as racially, ethnically, and religiously at odds with one another as it appears the president wants us to be. Usually, you know, the president's, in my view, with all due respect, it's been divide and conquer. The way he does better if he splits us. There's division. And I think people need hope. I think, look, George, I've never been more optimistic about the prospects for this country than I am today. And I really mean that. I think the people are ready. They understand what's at stake. And it's not about Democrat or Republican. If I get elected, you know, I'm running as a proud Democrat, but I'm going to be an American president. I'm going to take care of those who voted against me as well as those who voted for me.
All right. That answer.
Best answer of the debate by far. By a million miles, the best answer. And I'll tell you why. There was somebody, you understand, asked, what would it say about America if you lost? What was his first response? Well, maybe it'll say I was a lousy candidate, but I didn't do the job. That's a presidential answer. He took it on himself. It is the buck stops here, right? And so he begins with an acknowledgement of his own responsibility, not blaming other people, but actually taking it all on himself. And then he says that, you know, if that did happen, what he would hope is that it doesn't say America's irredeemable. It's the exact opposite of Donald Trump. There was nothing nothing in this campaign quite like that question and that answer. He answered it in a very calm way. He was a little slow. He paused to think about it. And yet, I found that answer thrilling. I found it exciting because it is very, very rare in American politics where a candidate is asked about their own foibles, about their own flaws, or about, you know, perhaps losing. And instead of doing the glib answer, which I expected, the glib answer saying, well, I'm not going to lose, he actually entertained the question seriously and offered a response that was incredibly powerful.
All right, before we go today, I'm going to ask you about a story NBC did last night about QAnon. And the president was asked about QAnon last night. But I want you to hear these people and what we're dealing with in 2020.
Suburban mom Mindy Wilson was horrified when a 3-year-old died outside Pittsburgh, allegedly from child abuse. Then a comment on a local news story took her to an internet conspiracy phenomenon known as QAnon.
I believe some of the theories could be true. I believe some of them are great fairy tales, but it all ties together.
She's convinced of a completely unfounded tenet of QAnon, that elite politicians and celebrities are running a child trafficking ring.
Hillary Clinton is involved in that. You've got a lot of professional movie stars and actresses and singers that are involved in that.
And if I were to say to you that everyone around them says these are rumors, these are conspiracy theories that are completely unfounded.
And that is a lie because Hillary Clinton is on video. There is raw footage of her out there torturing a little girl.
So if the former Secretary of State were sitting here and said, I've never harmed a child, that is not a real video, it's a fake video, you would
say— I would look her straight in the eyes and tell her that she's a liar.
So, how did we get to this point? These aren't just a few people anymore, John.
Mm-mm. No, you got candidates for Congress who buy into this, or at least buy into some elements.
Yes, I see that Kelly Loeffler has now taking the support of the woman in Georgia who's going to be a congresswoman.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, Kelly Loeffler is run a very special campaign.
Hasn't she?
Say that. Really, one of the most troubling things I've ever seen in history. And in Georgia politics, to have it be said that you've run a troubling campaign, that stands out.
She's making Lester Maddox blush.
Exactly. And you know, frankly, a lot of other bad players. I think the Talmadge family is feeling redeemed. But look, what's going on with this QAnon stuff? And by the way, it's come into Wisconsin politics as well, right? You know that there's charges about, you know, people again, retweeting things and stuff like that. So what you end up with is a situation where the Republican Party is straying into something that they strayed into at least once before in history, and that was when the John Birch Society was rising back in the 1950s into the early 1960s. There was a claim that, there were all these claims about Dwight Eisenhower, that Eisenhower was somehow a Russian agent or something like that. And, don't laugh. They were so off the deep end, they made Joe McCarthy look like a mainstream liberal. And it infected the Republican Party to such an extent that in 1964, Barry Goldwater became the party's nominee. But Goldwater wasn't a Bircher. But he, as you just suggested with, Loeffler, he accepted or at least kind of winked toward and allowed these extreme players to become a part of that campaign. It very nearly destroyed the Republican Party.
William F. Buckley say no?
He called him out.
Right.
He did an issue of National Review that called him out. And that was the beginning of a pushback. Now, after the Goldwater campaign, and it was so disastrous, there really was an effort by conservatives, like Buckley and others, and Reagan, to his credit, to sort of push these people, out, to push them to the sides and say, we're not going to accept that. And ultimately, they ended up like John Schmitz over in the American Party, which was the successor to George Wallace.
Oh, Mary Kay Letourneau's father.
Father, exactly. And we could go down a long trail here.
I got to know him a little. When Russ Feingold was first elected to the Senate, I was in Washington a lot, and so I would stop by a political memorabilia store at Union Station. He worked there, so I met him talked to him. Yeah, yeah.
He's actually a
very friendly, affable guy,
but a little crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But way out on the deep end. And so what I'm saying is that it took the Republican Party a long time and a lot of defeats. The John Birch Society, very active. Remember, it's headquartered up around Appleton, very active in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Republican Party really wrestled with it, and it was a big problem in the 60s. And I think that we should be covering QAnon, we should obviously be troubled by all the things they say, but we shouldn't be covering it casually. My sense is that we have something that's kind of embedding into the Republican Party at this point that is going to cause it severe problems, not merely in this cycle, but potentially in several cycles to come.
But not just QAnon. It's this living in alternative reality. There's an author, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name. His first name is Anon. He was on Morning Joe yesterday.
Yeah.
Okay, here's what he had to say.
It's Fox News multiplied by Facebook, which in many ways is the new Fox News. One of them's in your pocket and is particularly working with the addictive dynamics of your phone that are now better known. The other is this television portal into your brain, a different route. But let me make a hopeful version of the point, which is I actually don't think this era would have been possible without a substantial number of Trump voters essentially not living in reality, right? I don't think that, I would argue that 80% of Trump voters probably do not know or think to be true most of the most salient facts that would make one not vote for Donald Trump, right? I don't actually think a lot of those voters know those things, face those things, believe those things, and then still form a view of Trump as positive. I have spoken to many of those people. They live in a castle of fantasy. They don't know reality. And what that tells me is we don't have a problem. We have a problem of there being some number of people in this country who actually want the worst things for us. But there's a much larger number of people who are living in a media ecosystem. And I should say, I think it's Fox News primarily, to be sure, but I think we're all in this. We're all in this. Those of us in the media who do both sides' headlines, we're all guilty of it.
All right. How did we get to this point?
Oh, look, Bob McChesney have been writing books about it for years.
Right. That's why I asked.
For 20 years. Yeah, look, the reality is that Ben Benedicte, the great historian of media monopoly, wrote back in 1996. He said, you know, with the rise of the internet and the decline of local daily papers, right, the traditional paper that lands on your step in the morning or in the afternoon once upon a time, you're not going to have a structure that allows for the coverage of politics at the local granular level where we live. And slowly but surely, we're going to start to take our communications in at the national level, the international level. It's going to come driven by, and this is, remember, said in 96, this is going to be driven by a search for ratings and clicks. It's going to ultimately have information commodified to such an extent that people will be willing to peddle lies to uninformed folks. And those uninformed folks, not understanding that the media system has changed, will accept those lies as actual information. And it's, there's a lot of deep research on this, that how something is packaged. Literally, if you, you know, you put it on Twitter, you put it on Facebook, and it looks like it was done professionally, right? It's not, you know, like pasted together. It suddenly becomes believable for a lot of people. And we, what we did was we got rid of a tremendous number of journalists. We don't have journalism in America, at least not over, not at the level we need to have it. It's absolutely insufficient at the local, state, and national level. And we replaced it with, you know, a lot of politics, with a lot of literal, you know, political messaging, some of it lies, built around, you know, ginning people up, getting them excited, getting votes. And until we renew a traditional media in this country, doesn't have to be, I'm as probably more critical than anybody of the failures of media 20 years ago or 30 years ago, the profound failures, too deferent to the elite, too, you know, interested in going to war when we didn't have to go to war, a million complaints. But that doesn't mean that you don't need some there, that you don't need some sort of, you know, common ground on which people get information.
And to tell you, and at this pivotal moment during a pandemic, I think the issue that we're just discussing, I think has probably continued to drive the death count up in America with COVID-19. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation, thanks for coming to Sly's office.
Thank you. It's a good conversation, brother.
Sly'sOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.